Welcome to the Elevate Higher podcast, where CEOs, founders, and executives of early stage companies talk through their experiences of building teams.
Greg Terusin here, founder of Elevate Higher and host of the Elevate Higher podcast, where I talk with CEOs, founders, and executives about the challenges and successes they've had while recruiting for their teams. In this episode, we'll be discussing how first-time founders attract top talent, how properly communicating the impact of your company or your product is so powerful when hiring, and lessons learned from over 8 years of building and running a tech startup. This episode is brought to you by Elevate Higher, a talent acquisition advisory, consultancy, and execution firm who recruit leadership and senior level team members for early stage and rapidly growing companies. We believe that recruiting and retaining talent is key to having a successful company. In today's fast-moving and ever-changing economy, being able to recruit the right top-tier talent at the right time can differentiate the most successful companies from the rest of their field. If your company needs assistance recruiting key team members, improving your hiring processes, choosing and implementing recruiting tools, structuring and training your team, or if you need an advisor, then we can help. For more details, visit elevatehire.com. My guest today is Emmanuel Strashnov, co-CEO and founder of Bubble, a visual programming language for web and mobile applications whose goal is to make code obsolete. Emmanuel has a unique background and path to becoming a tech startup founder, so I'm excited to dive in here and find out more about his journey and what he's learned along the way. Welcome to the show, Emmanuel.
Hello, great to be here.
Thanks for making the time. I know things are pretty hectic for you guys right now, very busy, which is great to hear. So firstly, when we jump into the show, I like to hand it over to the guests to share more information about themselves and their background, and actually in your case, what actually made you start Bubble?
So I actually didn't start Bubble. My co-founder did, and I joined him after a few months. It was not incorporated at the time, so we both call ourselves founders.
Okay.
What he had at that point was a very early prototype, and I joined him, again, before there was no name, no incorporation, no company, but the concept was already there. And so he started that just, you know, witnessing firsthand, because he still is technical, the shortage of engineers in New York, and all these people having domain experts, having smart ideas that honestly deserve to exist, to see whether that could actually work as a company, mm-hmm. whether it's like a scaling startup or a niche product that would just make someone's job easier, or like a smaller community, a smaller group of people's life easier. And it was just not happening because you don't have enough engineers in the world. And if you're not well connected to raise funding, you basically will not be able to get this idea to life. And so everybody was pinging him. He had a personal experience himself as a tech co-founder of one of these niche products that didn't work out because it was not enough to sustain, to support his own life. And so he felt pretty strongly that it was wrong and we should find a software way to solve that. It's not a new idea. I mean, the idea of applying that to starting companies is fairly new. But the idea of making programming easy and visual is not new. I mean, people have tried to do that for the last 40 years of technology. Mm-hmm. If you think of it, you know, the jump from MS-DOS to Windows in the 80s was exactly about that. And it was using code to use a computer, and then Microsoft and Apple's Macintosh came and said, no, you're going to be using a graphic GUI, you know, graphic user interface to use a computer. We're doing the same thing for programming web apps. And so that's why we started it. We were like, you know, everybody needs to be able to create Airbnb-type platforms, Twitter-type platforms, without being technical, but just knowing how to use a tool. And so the tool we created takes about, you know, 5 hours, 10 hours, and then you can build these tools, these platforms yourself.
Very cool. Very cool. So I'll jump back into previous question in a second, but so who do you find tends to be your customers? Is it people who have their own website or own company that are trying to develop something just for that? Or are you finding it big companies or people just messing around as a hobby?
It's more like non-technical founders. So people mm-hmm. at the early stage of an idea where they're looking for developers, basically, tend okay. to come on us. A lot of hobbyists. You always have hobbyists, you know, because people talk about you on blogs. And I love hobbyists, by the way. Like, they come back to you when they actually need you, and they're great. Mm-hmm. Big companies, actually, there is a real need there. And so we have people coming from big companies as individuals because they looked at us, you know, during the weekend thinking, oh, maybe I could start a project or start a side hustle or something.
Interesting.
That said, we're not structured to serve large companies yet, something we'll do in the coming years. It's just a very different way to serve customers. We're very much doubling down today on people starting companies or starting products inside an existing organization, but that's not a big enterprise. It's usually more like small businesses and startups.
Okay, very cool, very cool. So going back to your background, because it's non-traditional, I took a step back and I look at tons of people's profiles every day, but how did you end up in a position to jump into a company like this? You were consulting, you were special assistant roles. What is it that actually made you jump into this so wholeheartedly?
It's a little bit strange, actually. So Josh and I decided to partner on our first coffee meeting. So it's really his idea, right, that I embraced pretty quickly. So I guess it's...
He sold
it's
you.
Really just, yeah, exactly. Like it was a kind of a love at first sight type of thing where we decided to partner on this full time immediately. Obviously, it's been 8 years and I've embraced the idea as much as he does now. And I consider this as much my idea as his, but he was one starting it. What I can tell you, why did I join, what I found it appealing is because I think this is one of the biggest problems that the business world is facing. The fact that engineers are the bottleneck for everything, the fact that a lot of ideas and a lot of pieces of software never exist because people don't see a $100 million market opportunity for them. Tech literacy at a more social level is a huge issue. Like you have, people and without, getting too much into this, like white male in Silicon Valley, creating software that everybody else uses. And I think it's a problem. I think the power to create needs to be shared with more people. And just telling people, well, you can learn how to code. People have tried to do that. If you think about it, when we started in 2012, that's what people were saying. In 2012, Barack Obama was going on TV and typing some lines of JavaScript. Michael Bloomberg was tweeting about Code Academy. So the world has changed. Like people don't tell that much, you should learn how to code, because the truth is, it's too easy to just tell someone, well, you can learn how to code. In practice, it doesn't work that way. Like you need to have started very young. And so I think this is a real problem. And Bubble is our shot to fix this computer literacy problem, which I think is only starting.
Amazing. Yeah. A question for you, just slightly off topic. What is your personal opinion or viewpoint on these code academies, boot camps and stuff like that, that are selling to people that want to pivot their career or, upskill or learn a new skill, frankly? Do you find that there's people that come out from there with a lot of quality? Is it a valuable thing?
It does work for some people. Mm-hmm. I think some boot camps for some people work out and people find great jobs after that. I don't think what I've noticed is that those boot camps prepare you for a job as a software engineer more than they prepare you to build things.
Yeah.
Which is different. I've rarely seen people start companies after a bootcamp. And to those people, I would really tell them, like, use something like a no-code tool like Bubble or some others, but don't spend, like $10,000 in 10 weeks on a bootcamp, because the likelihood you get to a position where you can actually build something real is fairly low.
Yeah.
If you're looking for a job and you're looking for like JavaScript credentials to get like a good paying job, it's better. It doesn't work for everyone though.
Right.
I think there has been a bubble. Not too, easy fun, but there has been a bubble around boot camps, which I think I don't want to say somewhere scams, but getting close to that. I think the market has corrected itself now. So
good. Yeah, I hope so. From my time internally.
I mean, for the record, I mean we bubble also sells boot camps.
Okay.
They're really cheap because
they're not the high end costing ones.
Like, I think right now we put like $750 for 8 sessions to learn how to use Bubble. So it's pretty cheap. But there is value in bootcamps and education. Mm-hmm. It's just like a $10,000 or taking something of your incoming salary after you graduate. It's a very expensive investment that does not necessarily lead to the job you hope for.
Yeah. As I was going to say, when I was interning, you get applicants, people that are eager to pivot in their career, or they've just gone through these boot camps that are supposed to gear them up for a position, actual professional role as a software engineer straight away. And I feel like it's so unfair what they've been sold sometimes, especially when, it's a double-edged sword, right? There is a lack of talent and you need to be competitive and always be recruiting and looking at other ways to fill your pipeline. But you also don't want to just hire anyone that's gone through a boot camp, because now, like you said, they haven't been always teed up to build things, and you need people to come in and build. So it's a slippery slope, you know, but yeah, I have seen people come out from there and thrive, but it's probably more the exception than the rule. But it's, I'm glad to hear that you think that the market starts to correct itself, because yeah, I was seeing boot camps pop up all over the place and charging crazy money or percentages, and it's just, it's not fair for the individual sometimes. Yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. So how has this changed, this career pivot for you, going from where you were beforehand into now being a co-founder and part of a tech startup? Was it daunting? Was it just super interesting? Were you worried about letting go of everything you'd done beforehand and jumping into this?
No, I don't know. Maybe I was completely stupid, but I was not worried at all, actually. I was coming out of school, and in many ways, you know, starting a company, especially if it's just two guys not raising money for a while, as we did, is a pretty similar lifestyle to being in school. Like, you don't go to classes, but, you know, you could be writing your PhD, your dissertation, dissertation, or writing code is pretty similar. So from a lifestyle perspective, it was pretty similar. The biggest thing for me is that I had to become technical again pretty quickly, which I was not expecting at first. I mean, it was kind of misunderstanding, I guess. Not a misunderstanding, but we call that Josh's double mistake, if you will. So Josh is my co-founder. He thought he needed a business guy. And I guess I was a business guy because I was graduating from business school. But first of all, that was a mistake. I mean, really, there was not much business to be done for the first few years because of how technical what we do is. And then the second mistake he made is to think I was a business guy, because even though I have an MBA, I'm much more of a product person at heart. Like, I was technical in high school. I was building a lot of things in high school, and I just rediscovered that. That said, I hadn't been writing code between the age of 18 to 29. So I basically missed the entire web thing. Like, the programming I was doing was on MS-DOS and Windows 95. So it was a long time ago. And so going back to that took a few months. And that was like the biggest change, I guess, in my early entrepreneurial career, was to become technical again.
Yeah.
But because we hadn't raised external funding, we actually had the time to spend to learn. I had the time to spend and learn things. Had we raised money, investors would have told us, hey, you're not here to learn how to code, just hire the coders.
Yeah.
And we decided not to raise money and do the thing we wanted to do our way, which turned out pretty well for us, actually.
I want to jump into that, actually. So two things. One, on your funding, you know, obviously bootstrapping and maybe self-funded, if we can talk about that a little bit. And then into your, what we were talking to offline, was your path to actually building a team and how long you guys waited. So I'm assuming they go hand in hand, if you want to share a bit more about that.
Yeah, so we decided not to raise money early on, just feeling that the product cycle was a bit too slow for traditional fundraising. Again, as I was saying earlier, what we're trying to do has been tried for decades. And so there's a lot of skepticism, because a lot of people have made that promise, you know, hey, you're going to build anything without code. And then all the engineers are like, this is bullshit, that can't work. And to be fair, they were true. I mean, like, for many years, all the previous agents were not delivering on the promise. And so we were like, let's not go to market too soon, because if you go to mass market, like, when I mean market is, we had like paying customers pretty much immediately, but it was a small crowd of people that we'd work with. But we didn't try to get in TechCrunch or anything like that early on, because we were like, if we try to go to the market too soon and try to get a lot of users with a product that's not powerful yet, you're going to reinforce the skepticism. So let's not do that. And so, because we felt it would take a few years, and whether we were right or wrong, we can discuss, but definitely more than the 8, 10, 1 year, 12 months it takes usually to go from the seed round or angel round to the next round. And so we felt the business was just not suitable for early funding as other startups. And so that's why we didn't raise money. And so, yes, so we ended fundraising last year, so after 6 years. Mm-hmm. And so before that, all of that, like, it was all organic. We ended, so it was just the two of us for 5 years, believe it or not, kind of doing everything. So I know we're going to talk more about hiring, but doing absolutely everything at the company with two guys is interesting. It's certainly, you develop, like, I process, for instance, myself, even though I was building the product, like, I was also doing customer success. I processed over 20,000 tickets myself.
Wow.
Like, it's a function I know extremely well. And I've seen all kinds of circumstances with users. And it's actually something I think as a company that we do pretty well on success, probably because of the exposure I've had. So there is a lot of value. On the flip side, it takes a little bit of time. If it were to do it again, we may have wanted to hire, to raise, not raise, but hire a little bit sooner, but by a few months, not by much more.
So or customer success specifically or just in general?
In general. Okay. Success specifically, but in general for everything. So yeah, and transitioning from that to doing absolutely everything ourselves, like not outsourcing a single thing, to started hiring specialists, like people that would do one thing and focus on that. So we started that in mid-2017, was a very interesting period for us. And so that led us to early 2019 with 12 people, profitable at that point. And then we decided to pull the trigger on fundraising to scale a little bit more aggressively.
That's really, really cool. And you don't really hear that a lot. You know, people have a great idea. Sometimes they're even raising money just purely off their PowerPoint with a view of jumping in straight to hire a team. So it's great that you guys were very aware.
It's a different approach.
Yeah.
Right. It's a different approach. I think it depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to build something like a marketplace, I think you need probably funding early on because you kind of need to fake it until you make it, you know, to create one side of the marketplace or something. For something like pure software, like we do, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I mean about having that awareness and about the market, knowing what you can actually do yourselves and being prepared to, you know, not everyone is prepared to. They have the idea, they have the drive, they know it's going to work eventually, but they're not prepared to do that for 5 years. It's a long time. That's a long time before you even think about bringing people in. And you were profitable, which is huge. So congratulations. So now let's talk about since then, since you've got your funding and now going into hiring your first team members, your core team, where you started, because it was just the two of you, now you've got to go through your whole delegation practice, right? What am I actually going to relinquish control on and bring a specialist in for? How did you decide that? And what were your first key hires?
So as I said, fundraising only happened after we got 10 people more on the team. So it started self-finance. But I mean, pretty traditionally, we started with engineers because at some point it became like Josh and I just coding everything ourselves was becoming a bottleneck. So we started with two engineers, hard to find. I mean, it spent a few months to find them, and that was difficult. Then success is something that one was especially easy for me to hire for because I had done it so much myself that it was fairly easy to manage someone to do that. And then operations. And that got us to a team of six, two customer success, one operations, two engineers, seven people. And after that, all except growth, we started hiring for growth later than everything else because the thing that happened when you just have two people for 5 years or is that you develop a new community. And so we had to serve that community of users and customers, like paying customers soon. So we had to invest on engineering and success before investing in growth. So growth happened maybe a year later, the first hires.
Interesting. Okay.
And to the thing around giving back control, it's actually something I have no problems with. I'm pretty comfortable doing that. It's something we can't abuse too much because like the bigger we get, the tougher it is. But our early community of, you know, users, they knew it was just the two of us. They were pretty understanding with mistakes when we would make a mistake or something. And so when the community is a community of people that are really, really big fans of the product, I mean, our users tend to be like, you know, 15 hours a day on Bubble. And the only things like they're really, really engaged. And there's a forum where people talk and stuff like that. So people are pretty passionate about it. So of course they're upset if someone makes a mistake, but that also means you can delegate and see how it plays out. And, you know, after a couple of weeks of delegating, honestly, most of the biggest mistakes that you haven't thought prior to the person doing them are already made. And then you move on and you do something else, you know, and like, people don't make mistakes anymore. So I didn't have too many problems myself delegating to people.
Great, great. And then what about leadership? Have you hired any key leaders apart from the two of you?
I mean, we had a head of product management who covers also business operations. So the area where he covers is pretty big.
Okay. Then
we promoted from within a head of success who started as a customer success associate, and he's now a lead of a team of six, probably seven soon. So yeah, promoting from the inside. That's the only place where we have like intermediate management, middle level management on the success side. Engineering is still going straight to Josh, and the growth team is going to me directly for now.
Great.
For some reason, like it's easier to promote from the inside for success than it was for the other positions we had. And on the flip side, a head of engineering, a head of growth that is not the right fit is a very costly mistake for a company.
Yeah.
And so it was pretty safe for us to promote a head of success from the inside. It's tougher to do that for the other role, so we decided to keep taking that ourselves.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah. Customer success is such a great function for internal promotion and everyone really internal mobility, and that they're the people that really know it from the ground up, and then they can also be most successful, and they know your customers better than anyone else. So
exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. And you're right. Head of engineering that doesn't work out is costly on a number of fronts, as you can imagine.
Yeah, this is really bad for the team morale.
Very dangerous. So what has attracting talent been like for you guys?
Tough. I mean, like it's a war, right? I mean, it's a war for talent everywhere. The bigger you get, the easier, especially in this sweet spot when you just raised around. The quality of inbound applications really goes up after you raise money, because whether it's a smart or not smart thing to do from people, I'm not here to comment on that, but you know, when you've been covered in the news with around with like famous investors, stuff like that, it does inspire trust, you know, like for candidates.
More PR and
right, exactly.
Of your product.
We did at first we would do trying to find people ourselves, like, you know, doing our cold outreach to people. Obviously looking at inbound things. We did recruit great people inbound days, but most of the good ones were actually coming from outreach or recruiting services, even though some were great, some were tougher.
Yeah. Is that per roles, or you're talking about actual partners, external partners, some were great and some were...
It was per role. Like it's mostly engineers, honestly, where it's the toughest. Growth is hard, but that one is kind of network-based. You have a lot of good people that could do growth at companies. You just need to be on their radar. But it's not necessarily super short supply. It's just about you need to make sure you have the right platform, because the good people are not necessarily looking. Engineers is just a supply. There's not enough people. And so you need to find them. Success for us is much more complicated than a lot of other companies, because we basically have to look at what people are building and trying to debug things for them, and like a lot of things we're trying to so it's much more technical. It's not engineering, but it's semi-engineering. You have to be a bubble expert. We found there are a lot of very bright people that want to get into technology, and starting with success with us is a very good way to do that. Actually, that's it's great. In many ways it's better than doing a boot camp, honestly. Because after 2 years on the success team at Bubble, you know web pretty well, like web development well, pretty well. People don't need to code, but actually adding code to their skills would probably be one of the easiest things, because they know how API works and a lot of things. And so for that, we have a pretty good pipeline, actually. Amazing. So inbound was pretty powerful.
Very cool. So for you guys, have you seen a value in recruiting using recruiting specialist partners? So whether that's thinking about, as you grow, hiring internal functions, people to focus on it, or partnering dedicated externally, or is it always in your mind going to be a hybrid model of, because, you know, as companies grow, they have a very robust referral program internally. For example, great hires come from referrals and you want to promote that consistently. Some say, hey, we don't want to bring that skill set in-house, we're always going to use external partners. And then some, it's a complete mixed bag. I'm just curious where you guys are at, or where your heads are.
I mean, at this stage, we're trying to figure it out. So because we're trying to figure it out, it will be hybrid for some time. We've tried we're doing everything. You know, we tried contractors. We're having someone in-house who helps a lot with, you know, well, office management when we have an office culture, kind of a HR person, interview planning, and also sourcing. So she tries as well. I do some sourcing myself. Referrals have worked pretty well so far. Like we have, I think, hired like 2 people so far out of 25 from referrals. So it's good. Not bad.
Yeah.
So we try everything. My guess is that we'll keep doing that for quite some time.
Yeah.
Until we decide to kill something. Also, I mean, the way it's structured with recruiters is that you pay on your success, you know, so... It's not very expensive to keep a line open and see what comes in.
See what comes in, for sure. That's good. Yeah, and also on the referral topic, when I headed up teams. And, you know, you look at stats a lot. I don't know if you guys are there looking at the data. You obviously know the number off the top of your head, how many referrals come in. Some people might say, well, that's not enough referrals to make hires from. But personally, I think that's a great portion of hires being made from referrals, because what you, the danger is when you get to close to like your 50% of hires being made from referrals, you tend to get this historic culture in your team that you never really created, because now you're just getting a bunch of people that are the same, where, and it's not really, obviously technically they're good and they come recommended, so they obviously carry a bit more weight and you take it a little bit more seriously. But then you have to have an eye on that and be like, how many people do we want from referrals? What's our sweet spot? And then let's push to other sources of candidates, because it's very important to have that mix that you guys have. I think it's super valuable.
Yeah, definitely. Something to be careful with.
Yeah, for sure. So obviously doing this for a while, you must have some gems and some key bits of information and advice that you can probably share with the listeners now around potentially team building itself, structuring your teams, hiring partnerships, or even employer branding, because you guys have, you're in a, such a unique space, right? Like you said, this problem has been tried to be attacked for so many years. Now you're at a point where you're successful with it, and communicating your product or your company is probably a key part of how you are managing to entice and attract talent.
Right.
What can you share with people that has been super valuable, or what you think, hey, these are things you can go and apply right now in your role or in your company?
So what we've struggled with, and I don't have a great answer yet, is engineering, mm-hmm. because engineers are not our target customer base. And so they come in because the product is cool, but they don't use it. And on the flip side though, and that has been pretty efficient with every other position, is whether it's growth or success, our users and our potential candidates are the same people, provided they are in New York, because we were not remote. Now we are for obvious reasons, but back then we were not. And so in terms of how we were like trying to attract talent, every effort we would do trying to attract users was also helping us with recruiting, which was pretty interesting. It's a lot because of the nature of our products. I don't know how replicable it is, but whether, you know, we target people as customers that want to start a tech company that are not super technical themselves. Mm-hmm. Well, usually someone who wants to do that, the likelihood they want to join a growing startup
that's just fun
is pretty high. So, yeah. And often we have users reaching out to us and, hey, by the way, are you hiring or something? Mm-hmm. When they do that, they're remote. And we used to say, no, maybe we'll change now. We'll see. So that has worked pretty well. It's because of the nature of our product. So it's not something, this is super replicable. On the flip side, for engineers, it was tougher because engineers are not users. And so it takes a little bit of work for us to, before the join, to attract them to submit applications, to communicate the value of the product, because they don't see it as much. And then once they're in, to make sure they know the product well, which was not simple. Like, we had situations at the beginning with our first hires where we realized after a year that they didn't know sub features that were not super advanced. Mm-hmm. And we're like, wow, that's actually a problem. Like, sometimes some engineers would pitch some ideas and we're like, wait, but we already have that.
Interesting. Okay.
And so we spent a lot of time. We actually wrote a bubble test. We might make it public one day if we want to let people self-certify or something. Like, people, we have a written test where you ask people questions about how to do things in bubble to make sure the coverage of their knowledge of the product is pretty deep. And that has proven to be very, very valuable when we do things. Another thing that we started doing, so this is more around, you know, culture and hiring the right people and communicating your value culture well, we put a lot of effort and energy in creating like a little deck in addition to the standard legal offer letter that we send to candidates, trying to explain, you know, what the first weeks will look like, the team we're trying to build. We try to create, we put there, you know, a culture statement that is a little bit antagonizing as much as possible without, you know, saying crazy things, because you want people to identify with the team you're trying to build, or you want someone, and sometimes, you know, they might be very smart, read that and say, oh no, that's not me, I don't want to go there. And not because it's a bad company, just because it's just not the right fit, because you want, it's important to attract people that will work well with the culture you're trying to build.
Yeah.
And so we spend quite some time putting together this deck to explain, you know, the culture you're trying to build, explain how stock options work, because that's a big component of the compensation at the startup, and people are not always clear about how that works, to be honest. And so it's fairly technical, so you need to explain how that works. That has worked so far. I mean, it's pretty new, but so far we have a pretty good hit rate in terms of people signing the offers after receiving it, so that's good.
I think more information isn't a bad thing. You know, I always strive to give that with giving an offer, you know, even down to the point when you touch on stock options, which for a lot of people haven't had to deal with them before. They've never been given them, especially if they're early in their career or if they work for big companies. So when a lot of them know what an RSU is, for example. So I like to give the comparison as well, that we don't offer that. We give ISOs, and this is what they could, you know, this is what strike price means, and this is what, you know, your vesting period is, and giving all of that information and comparisons. Because what gets confusing is someone goes away and talks to a parent or a colleague or a friend, and they're like, no, that's not how it works, because they don't understand there's different types of stock options, for example. Or your culture book, you know, Netflix very much moved the needle there by being very open, you know, giving that document out. So I think it's very valuable, and you can basically making people opt in to you as a company, eyes wide open, wholeheartedly, and they should be even more engaged on day one.
Yeah.
You would hope.
Yeah. you would hope. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I really liked what you said, though, and I really want to highlight that here before we sign out. But you basically are doubling up on your effort, or maximizing on the effort that's already being made there, by your users converting them to candidates. And I feel so strongly about that. I'm passionate about that, because if you already have that relationship with people, and then obviously you're in a unique situation where your product with certain teams. But if you flip that onto other aspects, and you may be a company that has storefronts, right? And general public would come in and never think about working there, because it might just be, you know, hourly employees or whatever, or store managers. But on the back end, if you're tech enabled, or if you have marketing functions, operations, and all that, your customer base may actually be employed by corporate. Think about how you can maximize that. As well, social recruiting. You may have people engaging with your social platforms, your social presence, your Instagram, your LinkedIn, your Twitter. How can you maximize that for hiring as well? Because again, they may not be aware about all the roles you hire for as a company. And I just speak from experience. You know, when I was at Hyperloop, for example, we obviously, everyone thinks about, wow, big moonshot idea. It must be all these, you know, very smart engineers and rocket scientists and whatever it is coming under one roof. But then we'd have a really big marketing and legal and operations function and software engineers. So opening the eyes to that, you can really get some very engaged and quality candidates that are passive. They just love you. They're already engaging with you in some way, whether it's your product or your service or your social network or even your storefront. So maximize on that, utilize it, put up adverts, you know, social recruiting, share stuff about your brand and your culture. It's going to reap huge rewards. Trust me.
So,
yeah. Anything else you want to share before we go? Or I think our time's almost up anyway.
Having been like just the two of us for 5 years, like the challenge is that you become extraordinarily good at what you're doing, because, you know, you repeat, like I could process, you know, like 50 success tickets in like an hour or something, like 2 hours, like it's extremely fast. Like when you build something, when you work on the same thing again and again and again, you become very, very good. And so the challenge with that is, when you start scaling the team, you take a huge hit in terms of productivity. And that was painful. Like my provocative way to define scaling is, you know, hire people and pay them to do something not as fast as you would do them yourself, which is a necessary pain to scale. Yeah. That's how it works, because you have to invest in them, and then they're actually going to get better than you, because it's just going to do that.
Right.
But it takes like a few months to get there. And so that's why I think it would have probably been better to hire a little bit sooner, to pay that cost a little bit earlier, because it was painful.
You wouldn't have had a dip in productivity, you're saying?
The drop of productivity would not have been that high. And so this is hard. Like, management is really hard, and especially coming from a place where it's just two guys building everything themselves without anyone, like without any management overhead, which is one of my big lessons over the last years. That said, I think management is one of the most exciting things you can work on, honestly. Creating, you know, a structure for people to perform, like creating systems that people are going to perform even better than they thought they would or they could, is an extremely rewarding thing. Like when you see someone actually getting better at doing something, this is really cool. It's a great feeling. And so I'm glad I'm discovering that as an entrepreneur compared to before, but it is hard. It's probably the hardest thing that I have to deal with on a daily basis, but it's somewhere we can learn a lot. So the recent like few weeks with COVID and quarantine and work from home has led to some interesting situations. Like even though as a business, we tend to be, honestly, the situation is helping us, I think, because people have more time in front of their computers. And so people are like, and they're trying to find ways to launch businesses, to make side revenue. So it's actually been helping us in terms of getting new users. It's been tough on the team and it's something new. So it's a lot of opportunities, but also tough. And on that one, that's a new chapter for us that we need to learn, like how to transition to remote culture, at least for a few months. It's not easy. And that's taking a lot of my time right now, trying to figure out how to do this efficiently.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. It's definitely growth pains, learning pains of starting out and being, you know, first time manager, growing teams, and that hiring people to do stuff that you did slower than you did is a tough one. It's a tough pill to swallow, but you know, they always say you sometimes have to slow down to speed up. And that's exactly what you guys had to do there. Slow down with that productivity. And now you have specialists. So yeah, great exactly. Advice about that timing of hiring. It's a balancing act for sure, especially when cash is tight, especially when you're trying to be mindful on spend. Okay. Well, look, thank you. We've been talking to Emmanuel Strashnov, who is the CEO, co-CEO and founder of Bubble. Emmanuel, where can people find out more about you and learn more about Bubble?
I mean, bubble.io is probably the best way. I'm on Twitter at Strashnov. And then if people want to be in touch and have specific questions, the best is to send an email to contact@bubble.io, which the team is small enough that if someone mentions something specific I said in this podcast, that would come to me.
Amazing. Okay, cool. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to getting this one published and people learning from you. And we'll stay in touch.
Yeah, thank you. That was fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Elevate Higher podcast. Be sure to click subscribe to get future episodes. Until next time.